Hi. Good. Okay. Do you mind if I turn off the lights? I had my eyes examined at 8:30 this morning, and they're still dilated, and I'm about to put my sunglasses on, but maybe I'll look like I've been smoking something I shouldn't. That was a ridiculous statement. I look like I've been smoking something I shouldn't. What should one smoke? Okay, I don't know anything one should smoke, so don't do that to your lungs. All right. Questions. We will offer the retake after class today. Yes. Right. So stick around if you want to take that. If you have to retake it and haven't done that and can't stay after class today, then you need to email Talia preferably and set up a time to do that, to retake it in the next week. Any other questions? We were cohabiting, I believe, and I want to go back to cohabiting. And think about what happens. This is where we had gone. What happens when couples move in together, when they're creating a microsystem that is completely unique because they haven't lived together before. And this couple has never lived together before. So, just recapping what I said on Wednesday last week, what happens is each of us has grown up in a variety of settings. We have a view of the ecosystem that we live in. We understand what couples are supposed to do. We understand how to keep house. We have our daily rhythms. And then we put those together, and we each bring our own into the cohabiting relationship. And at that point, we create a microsystem. And that means that we have to sort out the roles, relationships, and activities, and the pattern of them that will go on in this setting that we now share. So we talked a bit about how we do that, figuring out the activities, how to divide the labor if we're going to divide it, how to both contribute if we're both going to contribute, checking out the assumptions that go into the relationship and figuring out all of those financial and property and management and responsibility issues that come anytime you create a microsystem together. And I suggested that when we are a heterosexual couple and move in together, there is a natural tendency to adopt the traditional male-female roles. And I realize, in part because somebody suggested it after class, that I had made those roles sound bad. I want to make sure that you understand you may, with my blessing, adopt the traditional male-female roles of he takes care of the outside, she takes care of the inside, she takes care of laundry and cooking and cleaning and all of those things, and he takes care of the finances, or however you divide the responsibilities in a traditional relationship. My point was not that those are bad, but that many people go into a cohabiting situation or a marriage, either one, go into that situation expecting not to do the traditional roles. And they have every good intention of being equal, not being gendered in the way they divide the responsibilities in the microsystem. And my point simply was that when you move into that situation for the first time together, there will be pressure to adopt those roles. And your response to that pressure may be, oh goody, at last I can play little woman and have this big man take care of me, and I get to cook and clean and do all of those things that I was brought up to do and that I believe women ought to do. And that's fine. Fine by me. But it may not be fine by you if you think you should be equals, and if in the traditional role you end up being resentful of being in the traditional role and don't know how you got there. Because that's often what happens. After 3 or 4 months or 6 months, people are living out the traditional male-female division of labor, and one of them is feeling burdened, and the other one is happy. So when that happens, then you have to look at how you have defined the roles and whether or not you know how to carry out the roles of partners in the way that you want to. Because if you've not had good role models for equal roles, if you've not had good role models for non-gendered division of labor within a microsystem, you may not know how to live a non-gendered traditional relationship. So it's one of those things that you need to talk about in advance. And then if you don't want to fall into the traditional roles, you need to be vigilant about how you carry out those roles. And you need to agree and recognize that many of the periods when affect becomes more negative and the molar argument, the molar activity becomes argument, reciprocal argument, blaming, name-calling, regret, those sorts of things, then maybe we need to think about how we're carrying out the roles. Because often it is the inequity in the traditional roles that leads to the affect being negative, that leads to the arguments. There are other things to argue about too, but often it's the way the roles are defined. So, then you have food and furnishings and finances, and I think we ended with a suggestion that that microsystem that you've created fits into a mesosystem for both of you and for you as a couple, and the linkages and the relationships with those other settings are an important part of the cohabiting process. Beginning with, is there goal consensus across the other settings that you're involved in that you ought to be doing this? Or do you have somebody, probably a parent or a grandparent, who is out there saying, you're not ready for this, you shouldn't be doing this, you should be getting married first, you know, whatever the disagreement is or the disapproval, you have to deal with that. And when you go into those other settings, there may be disagreement in those microsystems about how you want to participate in those microsystems, and you run into the not under my roof phenomenon, which is, it's okay if you want to sleep together without benefit of marriage in Burlington when you're away at college doing those things that college students do, but when you come home, you get to sleep in your old bedroom and your partner gets to sleep in the guest room or on the sofa in the den, but you will not sleep together. I know none of you have experienced that yet, but it still is a phenomenon, and it is still the reality that when you move back into or go back into visiting in the setting in which you grew up, it may feel awkward to sleep with somebody in your extra long twin bed. Because that's what many of us had growing up, a twin bed. There was assumption that we would sleep alone. So you run into the wonderful experience of having a trundle bed or the bunk bed. There you are. Okay, which of us gets the top bunk and which of us gets the lower? But if you've played around with cohabiting or at least spending the night together in your residence hall room, you're used to snuggling up in a twin bed anyway, so, or even smaller than a twin. I think some of you have cots in a little thing. So you may be used to that. But in the other setting that is familiar to one of you, and you have an emotional attachment to that, and you fall back into your role of child when you move back, when you go back home, it may be difficult to maintain the kind of couple relationship that you can maintain in your cohabiting setting. When you move into other settings that one of you has familiarity with, it may be more awkward. It's kind of interesting to run into your partner's mother outside the, or father, outside the bathroom as you're waiting for your turn. What else do you run into in the mesosystem? I think I mentioned keys. Who has keys? I watched one. Actually, it wasn't a cohabiting couple, it was a married couple. I watched them run into difficulties because they had an apartment, they got married, and it turned out that the close group that they had hung out with while they were dating just expected that they would now hang out in the apartment of the married couple, which made a new home base for the hangers-out. And then the husband gave keys to several of his buddies so that they could come in and watch television while the happy couple was at work. And this did not sit well with the bride when she would come home and find the house full of smoke and beer bottles all over the living room and people having fun playing video games and watching television, when she was looking forward to a little peace and quiet and some alone time with the man she had married. Their divorce was particularly nasty. And they now speak civilly to each other on the rare occasions when they actually meet. It's been 12 years. But that was one of the things that precipitated the divorce, because when she complained, he didn't have a clue why this was a problem for her. Nor was he particularly understanding when his mesosystem, which included hanging out overnight with his buddies, why he maintained that, and he would just not come home because he'd gone fishing with the guys and forgot to leave a message for her. They kind of deserved each other, I think. Okay. What else happens in the mesosystem when you're cohabiting? What other horror stories have you heard or have you lived? Any of you inherited a younger sibling who's been thrown out of the house? Emily? Okay. A nice complicated microsystem. Yeah. Yep. And they've run into the macro system issues around being a gay couple living together and adoption and cross-racial adoption. And then the boyfriend moves in, so, right. I'm not going to touch that one. Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit. Not quite that, but we will talk about adoption and gay unions, civil unions. Any other horror stories? Mm-hmm. Okay, so the post-marital cohabitation, post-divorce cohabitation, the separation phase brings out a whole nother set of cohabitation issues when the setting may be the same, but the roles have changed, and the affect is usually in the tank. So what you're beginning to do is bring up situations where you have some of the same issues in different situations where you're making a transition, either a change in the role or a change in the setting and in role, as the relationship changes, either creating a relationship or taking a relationship apart. I love bringing in a new partner so that you can be together. In every case, the microsystem has to change. And in every case, the microsystem's relationships, the settings, relationships to other settings, the mesosystem connections, change. One of the fun ones to watch and to try to pull off, I guess, I've never tried to do it, but separated or divorced couples who want to maintain as much stability for their children as they possibly can, move in and out of the household so that the children can stay in their familiar household. And then if you have enough money, you can, you know, have a couple of different apartments and the original household, but that gets to be a financial drag. Or people live with their parents or friends when it's not their week or their month to be with the children in the original household. And some couples will rent one apartment, typically a two-bedroom apartment, put locks on the bedrooms, and move in and out of it, trading settings. And then they have to deal with, how do we manage this apartment microsystem that we never share, and the microsystem setting of the original household with the children, when we're never both there at the same time. So they have two settings for the family, but they keep switching back and forth, and the children get their stability. And then people work that out fairly well until they find signs that one couple that I know, the mother's 20-year younger boyfriend was staying in the apartment, and he occasionally forgot to leave. Well, once he forgot to leave before Dad got into the apartment, and so Dad came into the apartment, and Mom's 20 years younger boyfriend, these were people in their 50s, was still there and came wandering out of Mom's bedroom and was rather surprised to find Dad had moved back in. He'd sort of lost track of what day it was, so they had a little they had words with negative affect attached to them. So it was not an acceptable microsystem pattern for the dad to have Mom's boyfriend there when he was. Not going to happen. Okay. Who has access? Who gets to clean the apartment? Who gets to come in and eat your food? Who gets to stock your refrigerator? What are the assumptions that you bring into this arrangement? And what is the assumption, particularly about the developmental trajectory? As I mentioned, I think, on Wednesday, some of us go into those settings assuming that this is an intermediate step and there will be another role transition called marriage as we cohabit, and after we've cohabited for a few years, if that commitment for a marital relationship is not happening, then we begin to question not our own judgment, but the partner. There are issues around decision making, negotiation, how do you make changes in it, and how do you end it? How many people go into a cohabiting relationship defining at the beginning under what conditions they will end it and how they will resolve the disagreements about that? We encourage people to do that, to set it up. How are we going to make decisions? When are we going to counseling? How are we going to end it? What happens when we end it? Who gets the apartment and lease we talked about? How do you resolve disagreements? Well, I think it's time to move on to breaking up. I've been threatening to try a developmental analysis of breaking up, so here we go. Breaking up becomes a molar activity. It's also a role transition. If you're cohabiting, it becomes a setting transition, an ecological transition, your change of setting. So how do you do it? What are the implications for development when you break up? Remember, development is the view of the world that you have, and the skills and motivation you have for maintaining that world, your ecosystem, in a way that will serve you well. What happens when you break up, whether it's a relationship that's where you're not cohabiting, or whether it's a cohabiting relationship, or even a marriage? What happens when you start to break up? The major implication is that you have blown it. Your view of the world is not valid. You expected this to continue. You expected your partner not to cheat on you. You expected your partner not to discover when you were cheating. You expected that your partner would not mind if you did whatever it was that led to the breakup. So your view of your world is suspect when you break up. And all breakups include some self-doubt, some question about how did I get into this situation? Why is this happening to me? Whether you're the one initiating it or whether you're the one who's being dumped. How did I get into this? Why am I in the position of having to end this relationship? Why did I not see this coming? Why am I blindsided? Why didn't I have any clue that this was going to happen? I come home. This is what happened to the guy who let his friends take over the house and gave them keys. What happened? He came home one night. What's not in the apartment? His wife. His son. All the furniture. All of her stuff. And what is not in the bank? Anything. Nothing in the bank. She planned it. She gave him no word, no clue, other than having complained for 6 months about his denseness. So she planned it. She had a place to go. She pulled the truck up just after he went to work, unloaded the stuff from the apartment, withdrew everything from their joint bank account, and gone she was. That's why there was a little bit of negative affect around the divorce process. So you get to question your development, your view of the world, and then you get to see whether or not you have the skills to change the relationship in a way that is not going to cost you a lot of anxiety, a lot of money, a lot of blood pressure credits, a lot of lost sleep, did I say that? A lot of flunked courses or bad work at work or loss of job or any of those other things. Can you negotiate taking apart this microsystem, taking apart this relationship in a way that doesn't land you in the hospital or in jail? And can you come out of it feeling like you've done a pretty good job? Most of us can't. Most of us don't have the skills to end a relationship, if it's important to us, in a way that lets everybody feel good, lets everybody learn something, lets everybody feel like, okay, I've been treated fairly, that's all right. You know, most of us don't have those skills. And the people who do, you wonder, where did they get them? How have they practiced having the skill to end a relationship in a way that isn't maximally messy, which most of us do? Developmental status. Remember, the molar activities, the complexity and the variety of the molar activities that you engage in when nobody's telling you what to do. So what do you do in the process of breaking up? Can you do that molar activity? It's a fairly complex activity. And what do you do after you break up? Can you entertain yourself? Can you divide up the property in a reasonably fair way? Can you then go on about your life by yourself? Can you change your role? Can you go on about your business? Can you maintain the activities that you normally do without letting the breakup interfere with them? Can you call on your friends for support and maintain your integrity as a person and your sense of competence while you go through this breakup? Can you do that while the other person is spreading lies about you and complaining about your horrible behavior? And it's all lies, of course, because you would never behave badly. Right? Or can you say, yeah, I was a schmuck, and she was perfectly okay, perfectly justified in breaking up our relationship, and everything she says is probably okay. One of the difficulties, and we'll talk more about this in a few minutes, one of the difficulties in breaking up is that we do have our view of the world. And in the couple relationship, one of the things that we have done is try to bring our views of the world into congruence with each other. And that's an important part of couple building. We see the world in similar fashion. We have similar values. We define things in similar ways. We think we have similar priorities. What happens in a breakup often is that we want to continue that. We would love to have the partner share our view of the breakup and the relationship. So what we tend to do is try to convince the other person to see it our way. So couples who are breaking up engage in an extended activity of talking about the relationship and why they're breaking up. And what happens then is that most of the time they don't get to agreement, but they continue to seek agreement. So this extended molar activity leads in a couple of directions depending on the nature of the breakup. One of the potential directions is that you do agree, and in the process of agreeing there's some apology, and you realize, my goodness, I haven't been realistic about this, and I do in fact see what was annoying my partner and why she's having difficulty with this, and then we kiss and make up. And then we decide not to break up. So we move back in, or at least we start seeing each other again. and that lasts for a little while, and then we break up again, and then we go through the same process. And you see couples doing this yo-yo in and out of the relationship because they keep talking about it, and each time they make a little bit of progress toward agreeing on the relationship, and each time they do that, they see hope. And when they see hope, then they don't want to give up this investment they've made in this developmental trajectory of the relationship, so they get back together. And they may do that 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times, and then one of them, the one who's been keeping a journal, I recommend everybody to keep a journal about your relationship, you realize that you've written the same thing 5 times over the last year or year and a half. And you've made the same resolution to end this relationship 4 or 5 times. And you've actually tried it. And then you keep falling back into it. And at that point, your view of yourself in the world begins to get a little shaky. And eventually, you realize you have a repetition compulsion here. And that's really not healthy for you. This relationship is never going to make it. Because even though you can agree on parts of it each time you break up, the whole thing is really a disaster, or enough of a disaster that it's not going to work. So that's one of the potential directions. You agree, and then you get back together, and then you go through the yo-yo over and over again until you finally realize, can't do this anymore. It's driving me nuts. The other potential direction, or one of the other potential directions, is that the attempt to get the other person to agree leads to extended argument. And the arguments don't get resolved. You don't find common ground, except in thinking each other a fool and an idiot. And you keep doing it, rather than saying, I don't think I'll argue with a fool anymore because it makes me be a fool. I'm going to stop this. You end up escalating the argument because you have different views of the relationship and the world. And arguing becomes the molar activity that keeps you together until you call the cops, or until the neighbors call the cops, or until the restaurant throws you out because you are arguing so loudly and calling each other names. And so you part because the police are coming and, okay, you know, I'm out of here. But this compulsion to agree leads you a week later to call and say, okay, we did that badly. Can we talk? I need to talk. Many of us hate disagreement. And we hate when things won't fit. And we want the relationship to end positively, and our view of positive means we have to agree that we can't stay together. Well, if you could agree that you can't stay together, then you'd probably be able to stay together. The problem is that two people who have had major disagreements and can't resolve them are never going to reach agreement, except on the notion that the other person is an idiot and doesn't have any skills and has a totally invalid view of the world. But that's not flattering to the other person. The only way to end that gracefully is to step back and say, my view of the world is we don't have to agree. You get your script, I get my script, and I have no control over your script, you have no control over my script, we'll go live our scripts separately. We don't have to agree. And that's the more valid view of the world, in my opinion, that we can't agree. We don't need to agree. There's no reason to agree. Each of us gets our own script. We get to write it. And I'm just not going to worry about what the other person's script says about how awful I am. And I will try to behave around our mutual friends in a way that lets them judge whether I'm an idiot or not, based on my behavior, not on the basis of what it says in her script. And I'm not going to argue with my friends about whether her script is right or whether my script is right. I'm going to say, okay, we broke up. She gets to tell it her way. I get to tell it my way. I don't need to tell it. Let's go on about life. Let's work on our relationships. Let's go do our molar activities. Let's put that behind us. So, you didn't share a view of the world. You thought you did. Maybe you did, but then you stopped sharing a view of the world, and there's no reason why you have to get back to sharing a view of the world in the process of breaking up. What does it mean for the dyadic relation? What does breaking up do? What happens to the affect? Negative in the relationship. Reciprocity? Maybe. Stalking each other, harassing each other reciprocally, that's always good. It can be a high level of reciprocity. Arguing, stalking, calling each other names, cheating each other, you know, stealing things from each other, cutting the sleeves off his shirts, that was always a fun one. Burning his favorite books. A friend of mine and her ex, or about to be ex, had a wonderful exchange where they reciprocated in destroying each other's favorite things, symbolically and publicly, and that went on for quite a while. And the fascinating thing for me in the early phase of their breakup was that they were living separately, and he was bringing his shirts for her to launder and iron, and she was doing it. Because they weren't divorced yet, she sort of thought, well, you know, why not? And she said that. She said something about needing to go finish ironing his shirts. And two or three of us who were in the room were just, what? You're doing what? Let me get this straight. He's been having an affair with your best friend for probably several months, while she has been purporting to counsel you on how to save your relationship, which you knew was falling apart, and you're ironing his shirts. What are you doing to them? Itching powder? Are you shrinking them? Are you destroying? No. It hadn't occurred to her to do that. So we suggested she stop, and she did. But then they went through 3 or 4 months of stepping on his model airplanes that he'd had from childhood. His favorite record was the soundtrack from the one you use to psych yourself up for running races. Chariots of Fire. Right. Chariots of Fire. So he came to pick up his records, and she pulled that one out of the... That was back in the vinyl days. You don't remember that. Okay. She pulled it out. She said, okay, here. And she wrapped Chariots of Fire around her knee. And he stepped on her favorite angel food cake pan. Flattened it. Just wonderfully childish, petty things. This was a couple I really loved knowing, because it was like 2 4-year-olds divorcing. They eventually got over it. But the affect was very negative. The reciprocity was very high. And they were equally powerful in this. Lila. Yep. The list of nasties. We could publish a book. We could publish a book. What was the movie? His stuff went in his BMW and she lit it on fire. Breathing. Breathe. Anyway, you missed that one? It was great. They were a wealthy couple, and she took all of his suits, and put them in his BMW and waiting to breathe. Huh? Exhale. Breathing, exhale, they're synonymous. Thank you. Okay, waiting to exhale. Well, she burned the BMW and the suits. Yeah, there's a long list of those. And compared to what other people do to hurt each other, as the affect gets negative, and people are reciprocally hurting each other, compared to that, burning the suits in the BMW is fairly negative. The most common time for people to come to blows is when they're breaking up, whether it's a relationship, a cohabiting relationship, or a marriage. You are most likely to get hurt by your partner during the process of breaking up. You are most likely to get killed by your abusive partner during the separation process. He didn't kill you all of those years, but when you leave, he may. And that's very serious.
Isn't there also, especially in a lot of rape situations that can involve in that situation where the husband will and for a big sense of being legal, that would be technically the last because the person is there. But sometimes
it was only probably 20 years ago, don't quote me, but within the last two decades, that having forced intercourse with your spouse was declared to be rape, sexual assault. And it is very common for women to be raped during the separation period, and it is unfortunately common for ex-husbands to sexually assault ex-wives. And the difficulty there moves us to the microsystem, the role in the microsystem for partners is that there will be a sexual relationship. And that's part of one of the molar activities that the couple engages in jointly. And when you separate, when you break up, that activity and the roles of sexual partners have to be given up. You have to leave that role. You have to stop engaging in that molar activity. For many couples, stepping out of that role and ending that molar activity, not engaging in it anymore, is one of the reasons for breaking up. They've stopped having sex with each other because they don't like each other, or they've cheated, or there are all kinds of things there. But during the process of breaking up, some people have a great deal of difficulty with changing, giving up that activity, and recognizing that you will never have sex with this person again, and you will never be this person's partner again. If you're going to break up gracefully, you say, okay, you never get to sleep with me again. Yeah, 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 yeah. That's okay, right? And I will no longer sleep with you, and we won't have sex together, and that's all there is to it. We're done with that. We don't have that responsibility or privilege with each other anymore, and then you move on. It's very difficult to give up some of your favorite molar activities, which is why it is so common for separating couples to fall back into bed with each other. It's very common for divorced couples, when they're not dating somebody else, to get back together and have sex. Well, you know, they're familiar and they've gotten over the negative affect and they know how it works with the partner and you're having a good time, so you fall into bed again. And some couples do that for years if they don't form new partnerships. Some couples divorce, live separately, and discover they kind of like each other if they don't have to live with each other. The microsystem pattern was the problem, and the role of being husband and wife. They did pretty well as lovers before they got married, and they can continue pretty well as lovers because they're not responsible for each other except in the sexual relationship. It becomes an isolated molar activity that may be quite important and happy for both of them. Same time next year, with no obligation in between. The problem with the roles of husband and wife or partners, there are a whole bunch of obligations that interfere with having a good sexual relationship. As you know, marriage can ruin a good sexual relationship. Children do it too. So it's complication. But what happens for many couples is that giving up the activity and giving up the role as this person's only sexual partner is very painful. And you don't want to give it up. So you continue it even over the protests of your partner. That's called rape. And before the divorce decree, it was not considered rape until a few years ago. Even if you were separated, if you were the man and you came into the house and raped your about-to-be ex-wife, it was still legal for you to do that because forced sex was part of the marital relationship. Now it's not. And you can't do that. Even if you're married, you may not force the other person to have a sexual relationship with you. Either sex. It's sexual assault. And you can be prosecuted for it if the other person wants to file charges, which will probably lead to a separation and divorce if you do that. But it's important to know that nobody can force you, even if you're married, to have a sexual relationship with you. You may need to go to counseling to figure that out, but it's not legal. It is sexual assault. Rape during the separation, during the breakup, and after the breakup is unfortunately very common. And there are lots of reasons for that. Partly, it's simply an invalid view of the world and of yourself and what is appropriate. So people who are breaking up do all kinds of things to maintain the relationship, to maintain their knowledge of each other, and almost all of those things are, if not inappropriate, illegal. Many of them are simply illegal. Stalking is illegal. You do not have the right to know what your ex-partner is doing, or to spy on her or him, or to invade his or her space, or tap his or her phone, or hack into her computer or his computer, the email system. Stalking is illegal. Even if the other person doesn't know you're doing it, it's illegal. But what it is an attempt to maintain the familiar relationship and activities. And rape and sexual assault take a big leap up when the former partner discovers that you have a new sexual relationship, that you're dating, that you have a new sexual relationship with somebody. That reality that he or she has been replaced brings out the worst behavior in people. And rather than having the valid view that says, well, she can do whatever she wants, not my business, people will decide it is their business, she can't do whatever she wants, and rape and murder become, unfortunately, much too common. So, don't. Don't.
Also, if you look at statistics, like in the past year and a half, there was a research of there was a report of adolescent shows that out of
I'm sorry, that what? Yeah, that. If. Yeah. And that comment is that in the cases of sexual assault on campus, right, almost all involve people who know each other. You can extend that statistic if you look at murders anywhere. You are most likely to be murdered by somebody who is close to you. Yeah. Most of us don't go around just shooting people, and that's the bizarre thing about drive-by shootings. You know, many of them are gang-related, but some of them are just random. And those strike us as so bizarre because we're used to people killing each other because they love them, or they used to. And they have a close relationship and strong affect about each other, and they lose it, and they kill each other. So you're much more likely to be killed by somebody who used to or should love you than you are by a stranger. You know, getting killed by a stranger is about the same probability as getting hit by lightning. Yeah. It does happen, but it's not likely to happen to you. It's your loved ones who are more likely to kill you. Or people who used to be your loved ones, your ex-loved ones. Also, if you didn't get the handout down here, get one after. It's on the tactics of psychological abuse. It's about relationships. And it includes one side is about child abuse, the other side is domestic violence. The same kinds of tactics. But it's about relationships. And it's about the affect and the reciprocity and the activities that go on within the and the power that go on within a relationship. Okay. So when you break up, you get to establish your own microsystem. You have to deal without the other person. Mesosystem links are changed. That's often very difficult. You have friends in common. They often feel like they need to take sides, or they often do, and they don't want to associate with one or the other of you before, that they associated with before. And they're going to invite one or the other of you, but probably not both of you, to share settings with them. So you get left out of mesosystem settings that you have been used to going into, and you know that the other person is there. So you did vacations together with family, and you really enjoyed those, and now you're not together anymore, and you know that the other person is enjoying that, and you never get to do that again. So it makes you depressed. Your affect becomes negative because of what you're losing. You're losing those settings. You run into awkward situations. You go downtown, you go to Nectar's, there she is, there he is, new partner, or flirting, or trying to pick somebody else up, and it raises all those negative feelings again. So it has an impact on the mesosystem. And it interrupts the developmental trajectory. Most of us don't go into a relationship expecting that it will end, although realistically most of them do, but we expect it to go in a different direction, that we will continue to share settings and that the settings that we go into will promote the couple relationship, and we will do that, and that gets derailed. And for many couples, as they've thought about the future, they've defined those future settings and activities. They've talked about them. There is a plan, maybe informal, it may be fairly formal, about what's going to happen, and then they break up. And that plan, that implicit or explicit developmental trajectory, is gone. So that's another of the losses. So you've lost familiar activities, you've lost the role of partner, you may have lost settings, you may have lost a developmental trajectory and may not know how to get on a different one. You have to go through the dating process again and finding other partners. Unless you're the one who screwed it up by already having another partner and going off on a different trajectory already, which you may have done. But for at least one person, there are a whole bunch of losses here. So there's grief. There's grief involved in the breaking up process as you adapt to all of these changes in your ecosystem. The changes in role, changes in setting, changes in the mesosystem, exosystem settings that were important to the partner, where you may have known what was going on. People may have inquired about you. They may have known you. Those connections get lost. And what is the macrosystem saying about you? If you want to know what the macrosystem setting is saying about you, go to the greeting card section of your local drugstore, or your card store, or your grocery store, and look at the cards that are designed for people who are breaking up. Hallmark will never miss an opportunity to celebrate an ecological transition. That's how they make their money. If we invent new ecological transitions, Hallmark will develop a line of cards for that ecological transition. You know, they will. And it may be a sympathy card. It may be let's get even card. It may be a, okay, sister, we're on your side. Let's go get him. One of my favorites I'll show you. Remind me at the end of this semester, I have a card. I'll scan it and put it up there. It's one of my favorites from my divorce course. A greeting card that somebody found for me and shared with me. So the macro system is saying, you have been wronged. Yeah. And this is not good. And now we have all of these feelings that we have to deal with. The macro system for the wronged one is suggesting retaliation and getting even. One of the beliefs in the macro system is that you take the high road and let the other person deal. And you always behave as a reasonable person. Take the high road, never say anything bad about the ex. Don't explain to other people what he or she did wrong. You don't need to. What the macro system has not done particularly well yet is to help us understand how to take a relationship apart relatively gracefully. But we all do have beliefs and expectations about what should happen. And I shared one of those a week or so ago with the notion that in dating, if you go into the relationship with the expectation that when the romantic part of it ends, you will still be friends, then you behave differently as you break up. If you're changing the relationship but want to maintain the friendship, you behave differently. That's more difficult if one person has behaved in a way that makes him or her not a person you'd want to be a friend with. Okay. So if you don't want to maintain the friendship because the person turned out to be a low-life schmuck, then you may not be able to carry out your intent. But at least if you both have that intent and have just decided that, okay, can't work it out, then we will treat each other nicely as we go through this process. No stalking, no harassing, no name-calling, no reciprocal nastiness. We'll maintain the affect as positively as we can. That makes sense? Okay. Let me ask a kind of review question here. Oh, we could do this as a writing exercise. Sure. We could do that. Think about cohabitation and the moving in together process, which we've talked about for most of a couple of days. Why is it an ecological transition? And how does it change your ecosystem? You may use your notes. Just summarize it as concisely as you can in a few minutes. And when you're finished, just bring it down and put it on the table, and that'll give you a chance to pick up the handout on abuse if you didn't. And for those listening on the web, the writing exercise, forget the date. I had it with me last Wednesday, but we didn't do it. So today is the 26th of March. The writing exercise is explain A, why moving into a new apartment together with one's partner, cohabiting, is an ecological transition, and B, how it changes one's ecosystem.